Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast, the sibling podcast to the award-winning weekly paper. I'm Jesse Billington, the staff writer, and I'm joined this week by our editor, David Simister. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Good to catch up again about the hot topics in the classic car world.
There's quite a few hot topics to get through this week, actually.
Absolutely.
We've had a bumper crop of news coming through, and it's relatively good news for that matter as well. And you've been very much at the focus of it. You've had a trip off to the Club Expo and come back with some insightful stories.
Absolutely. So Club Expo, for listeners who might not be aware, is a big seminar that's hosted by the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs once a year. It's a really useful opportunity for sort of the movers and shakers from the nation's car clubs to get together. This year they had 185 delegates there, and what they do essentially is they all gather them in a room at Gaydon and they talk about some of the really hot topics and big developments that are happening in the classic car world that will affect you, the classic car owner.
It's a great way to sort of touch base and sort of, again, that interclub or sort of across club sort of communication helps sort of keep the hobby as healthy as it is. And well, there's been some great stories come out of it, some great advances in the worlds of classics. We've got the main one is this new survey that's sort of set to sort of come out soon. And how many respondents are we looking for from the FHBC looking for? What sort of questions do we know it's going to entail? And what's the ultimate end goal for this sort of big survey across the clubs?
So this was our cover story on this week's issue of Classic Car Weekly, and it's a biggie. It's the National Historic Vehicle Survey. Again, this is conducted by the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs. And the idea with it is that they ask you, the classic car owner, the clubs, the businesses, the museums, everyone who's got an interest in something to do with classic cars. It's a big survey. It's kind of a state of the nation almost, asking what it is you do with your classic cars, how much do you spend on them, how far do you drive them, what kind of events do you take them through it to, all of these things. And it's a massive piece of information that the Federation gathers over the course of 3 months. They're launching it on the 10th of February, so we will obviously share details of that when it comes out in Classic Car Weekly. But the ramifications of this are huge. They carry this out every 5 years or so. And certainly the feedback I got from the Federation at Club Expo was that the last one they carried out, the results were maybe a little bit stunted almost by something called the COVID-19 pandemic. So this is the first really big piece of research that they've carried out for pretty much a decade now. And the reason why it's so important is because the information that we and all of you guys out there and specialists across the country, the information that comes back for that survey, that is used. They don't just sit there and go, oh, that's a lovely bit of information we've got there. That information is taken to Westminster, to local authorities across the country. In previous cases, it was taken to Europe. And all of this information is used to build a picture of why Britain's historic vehicle movement is so important. We refer to some of the last findings quite a lot. We talk about the fact that the historic vehicle movement is worth £7.2 billion to the nation's economy, which is a huge amount when you think about it. That's it's bigger than golf, to give you an idea of how important the classic car hobby is. It supports more than 34,000 jobs across the UK, and it's also shown that more than 18 million people across the UK think that the old cars that we drive around in are a significant part of our heritage. So these are all the facts and figures that when people in Westminster, all the MPs and the lawmakers and the lobbyists, when they all come together and they sit down and think, okay, what laws do we want to bring in that might restrict people's ability to, you know, use and drive cars? That's the piece of paper that they want to be able to show the lawmakers, to say, hang on a minute, guys, classic cars are really important. Let's not be restricting what they can do, because they bring a huge amount to Britain's heritage and to its economy.
It's a useful piece of evidence to have to hand when it comes to things like preserving fuel standards and preserving sort of when it comes to accessibility for parts, and also things like access to sort of appropriate MOTs, service stations, vehicle safety checks, everything along those lines. Having this sort of background of data as to what this means on a broad enough scale is sort of important. And it's great to see the FBHBC sort of again bringing back that survey and finding that data and keeping it up to date, because it's a great way of sort of strengthening our position when it comes to that bigger political table.
Absolutely. And yeah, they're not mucking about with that either. It's they're looking to get 19,000 responses, which is a huge number. You think about opinion polls, which are often used to guide decisions at Westminster. They're often conducted on the view basis of 2,000 people. So to have the views of 19,000 people is a huge piece, a huge weighty thing that we can use to help certainly influence what happens in Westminster that might affect laws to come. So I think the certainly the message that the Federation are very keen to get out is when this survey does go live, spend 10, 20 minutes filling it in, because those findings are going to be useful for years to come.
Yeah, it's going to be a very crucial tool when it comes to preservation of the hobby. Obviously, you mentioned how this sort of helps our steer with Westminster, helps sort of inform our communications with them. There's been an update when it comes from the DVLA as well, when they're sort of potentially taking on board some of the criticisms and points laid out in previous seminars across last year, and obviously the call for evidence.
Yeah, again, this is quite an interesting development from Club Expo. So regular listeners to the podcast and people who pick up Classic Car Week quite a bit will be aware there's quite a lot of going on with the how the DVLA works and responds to cases raised that involve classic cars. They had a call for evidence which was instigated by the Department for Transport last year, and that was a really big, again, it was again asking the hobby what is it that can be done better to help classic car owners, very similar to the survey in some senses. And they came back over Christmas with again lots of their findings, things that classic car owners were telling them. But at the same time, representatives from the Federation and also the HCVA, which is the Historic Classic Vehicles Alliance, they went to Swansea to meet with people from the DVLA, and they got a bit of a taster of some of the things that the DVLA are working on. And the thing to stress at the moment is these are very much proposals; these are not done deals at this stage. But certainly the indications coming from Swansea is that if you're restoring a car and you're looking to get it re-registered, or you're looking to maybe, I don't know, put a different engine in or something like that, the basic premise of what they're trying to do now is that they will always try and keep your car on its original registration plate wherever possible, or possibly an age-related one that is issued by the agency, but they will try and avoid giving your car a Q plate unless it's absolutely necessary. And there will probably be some outliers and some strange cars that come out of barns and garages that they may still need to give them Q plates. But certainly, if you find an Austin A35 in a barn and it's clearly got the original registration plates still rusted to the chrome front bumper, they will try and keep that registration on the car if they can.
I think that's it's important they're sort of making this move to listening to what the classic car hobby is saying, and sort of taking the expert-led sort of opinion and advice that has been sort of laid out for them, and taking it on board with a good measure of common sense. Because we do hear the occasional story of people that are sort of re-imported, repatriated classic vehicles, and they've been slapped with modern-day license plates because the DVLA doesn't understand, doesn't know. Be critical to say doesn't care, but given the fact they're looking to make changes, suggests possibly otherwise now at least. But it means that sort of your classic will be treated period appropriately. You won't be hit with emissions regulations that it ultimately cannot pass. I think at one point last year I was sort of tracking down the story of a chap who had repatriated an Elvis and was struggling to get it put onto age-related plates. The problem was it was put onto incredibly modern plates from when it was re-imported, and he meant it had to go through an MOT and was expected to pass modern day emissions tests, which had no chance of doing. So it's good that these sort of obstacles that people have come across are now sort of being appropriately raised and listened to and dealt with.
Yes, I think certainly that's going to be something that's going to be really key to watch. And I know certainly the feedback I got coming out of the Club Expo is that this is one that they're going to keep talking to the DVLA about, because it's very much a work in progress. Certainly the thing that I think is really important when the DVLA are drawing up these rules, they've got the findings, we've shared them in Classic Car Weekly already. Now the thing is dialogue, because the DVLA is a huge organization. They have to deal with many thousands of registration applications for all sorts of cars across the country every single day, and they don't necessarily have a huge amount of classic car knowledge within the walls of the DVLA in Swansea. So I think it's really important that when they are trying to work out what these rules are and how to make it work for classic car owners, they are talking to people like the Federation, people, car clubs, classic car businesses, restoration firms, all these people, because these are the people who really know the cars inside out and they know what's going to work and what isn't. So I think the most important thing out of all of this is dialogue.
And there is a lot of positively vested interest in these sort of businesses being able to supply that information, that expertise, because they're important businesses to sort of keep going and supporting it. They're a functional part of the British economy. You mentioned how much the classic car hobby is worth supporting this sort of from its grassroots, and keeping it sort of stable and encouraged is just as important as obviously making sure cars are on the right registration. And one of the other stories that you've come back with is the new archive for clubs launched as well, which looks to be a great technological step forwards.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is it's not a brand new, they've just pulled it out of a hat there. And then this is more than 18 months in the making. So Andy Bye, who is one of the Federation's directors, he's also quite closely involved, some of you will be aware, in a project called the Roots Archive Centre Trust. So this was a really big project which took place over the course of, it's nearly a decade now, of again preserving lots of all those wonderful blueprints and brochures and things that would have otherwise been lost to history. So they've already had really good form with what they've done with Roots. And the idea with this is that most car clubs have, I'm sure, in boxes in garages or hidden away in lofts, they have boxes and boxes just full of old period brochures and design drawings and historical artifacts and so on, which people never get to see because they're just stuck in lofts, and never going to see the light of day. The idea with this is that the Federation is providing a service for clubs, and it starts at about 400 quid for the year, which for most car clubs is relatively affordable. The idea is that you can go along, you can get your stuff scanned in, and then anybody, right, any part of the world can see those wonderful bits of history for the first time. So it's a really, really useful way of doing it. And the great thing with it all being coordinated by one organisation is that you don't have an MG club and a Triumph club and a Ford club all trying to do the same piece of work over and over again. It's already there, it exists, and it's a ready-made way for getting motoring history online so people can see it.
And it's not just sort of the preservation of the history, it's also sort of the access to it that's then sort of a very important thing when it comes to reproduction of parts and sort of again keeping cars on the road, keeping cars going. If you've got blueprints, designs, technical drawings that are able to be preserved in this incredibly sort of efficient manner, it's going to be great when it comes to certainly the more obscure clubs. I'm very fortunate in the fact that I can simply go online and just buy more bits for my MG, but when it gets to smaller clubs, it mentions in the article Roots Archive and Daimler and Lanchester, they aren't cars that you can readily go and get bits for in quite the same way that you can for the more common classics. So sort of preserving the technical details that are also just as important to keeping these cars on the road is very handy indeed. And I do like a good archive. Like, you can spend hours on hours stashed away in an archive just leafing through fantastic sheaths of history.
Well, it's the same with me, bringing it closer to home. I love the Classic Car Weekly archive, which is a hidden in a bunker behind, beneath our headquarters. There are bounders, there are bound volumes full of old copies of Classic Car Weekly going back 35 years. And again, currently, a lot of that information doesn't get seen beyond that room.
You do like to mention it when you've written one of our sort of The Way We Were, as you sort of dip back in and go for sort of a front cover from that point in time.
I love it because, again, it's bringing history back to life, isn't it? Things that haven't been seen for, in some cases, generations.
It's also terrifying when you see the prices of what some of the cars were fetching sort of 20, 30 years ago, and you sort of go, ooh, that's
Oh yeah, well, I was going to say, I think in our very one of the ones I love coming back to is in our very first issue. There was a story about an Aston Martin DB6 fetching a record price of £33,000. And you're there just thinking that's nowadays that's what VW Golf money, isn't it? In terms of
I don't
what you
even
can
think
buy
that's
and you
getting
can...
into a VW Golf these days,
No,
terrifyingly.
that's it. But you could have a lovely Aston Martin DB6 for that kind of movie. But nowadays you would add another zero to that price quite happily.
Quite easily, yes. Yeah, I'll do some maths and figure out what that is in relation to inflation and also in relation to the car's current worth and see which one's the
Yes.
more scary number. I should think the car's actual worth has outstripped inflation there, but there we go. The fun of history and a good archive. So it sounds like a productive trip up to the Club Expo and again, a great way to commemorate the incredible work the Federation does when it comes to supporting the clubs that support our cars as well. So well worth the time, and again, it's great to see the effort they're putting in and the incredible work that goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, definitely. There is a, that is one thing that is really worth stressing, is a lot of whichever car club you're a member of, and we come to this again every March when we have the National Car Club Awards. Yeah, if you join, it's not just this, you put your money in, they send you a lovely newsletter once every couple of months. There's a phenomenal amount of work that goes on to keep car club, car clubs do a fantastic job in terms of keeping our motoring heritage on the road.
Yeah, the history, the politics, the engineering, there's a lot more to it than just your lovely club magazine that comes through once a month and the odd meetup. We'll
Definitely.
delve elsewhere into our news pages and we'll take a look at the story that is on page three. And this is dwindling spares are a threat to modern classics. This is quite an interesting one because we don't often think about classics or cars that are on the edge of extinction. And the most terrifying part is some of these cars came onto production and left production during my lifetime. I remember the launches of some of these cars just about, and yeah, it's a little bit shocking for me to be sort of reminded as to quite how old I am, and I'm certainly the youngest on the team, but it's that question over modern classics and how much longer are we going to see them on the road.
I think, and I said this in my, my editorial comment piece on the top of the story. I mean, I take it with a not so much a pinch of salt, but a fairly, I could get a lorry from Saxo to reverse and pour the contents of said lorry over my shoulder, because I think claiming that cars are going to be extinct full stop, I think is, I think it's risky to say the least, and certainly quite a few clubs have quite robustly rebuffed those claims. Certainly think the example that we touched on in that story was the Metro, and it was suggested that in this particular press release from an insurance company that that car will be completely extinct within the next 5 to 6 years. We know that there are plenty of people who own and love Metros, Austins, Rovers, MGs. They absolutely dote on them, and we know for a fact that we are going to be seeing those at classic car events for decades to come. So I think it would be a bit of a misnomer to suggest that these cars are going to be completely extinct, full stop. That happens very rarely. I think most cars in the country, there's still at least one surviving example of something, even if it's in a museum somewhere. But it does talk to a very important wider point, which again is around the availability of spares and how they help to keep numbers of those cars in sort of in real numbers on our roads. And certainly things like cars like the Metro, I think I read somewhere once, I think there's fewer than 1% of the Metros made are still on the roads. So obviously there is a challenge there, and things like the cars like the Metro and so on are fairly well established in classic numbers. Some of those other cars, there's in the list, which there were a list of 30 cars that were deemed to be at risk of extinction, and some of them I'm just not sure if they have a particularly sort of huge or passionate following yet in the world of classics.
I'd say that some of them are certainly teetering on the edge of it when it comes to things like the Citroën Saxo, the Peugeot 106. They've started to earn their classic colours with the generations that sort of had them as first cars now sort of coming back around to them as sort of enthusiast cars. But when it comes to sort of certain other cars, the Mercedes ML, I'm surprised at that being on the list, especially the 2005 through 2012 model, because I can remember there was certainly the predecessor to it as well, which was a lot more popular. And again, maybe it doesn't help that it was a star in Jurassic Park 2, one of the least popular Jurassic Park sequels. So maybe that sort of didn't help its longevity there. But
I was going to say there are cars on the list, and I've got it in front of me. There are certain cars, and I think the common theme with all these, so cars that have a certain nostalgia factor, the my dad had one factor to them. So For example, the Vauxhall Cavalier Mark III. I think that there are plenty of people who either remember driving them as sales reps in the 90s, or they remember their dad taking them to school in one. So I think there will always be a groundswell of support for those sorts of cars. But there are others where you think actually these are cars that are probably from the mid to late noughties, where they might not have the same sort of fan base, and they were maybe a bit also around when they were new, things like the Peugeot 1007. I don't remember that being a particularly hit car even when it was new.
It was divisive because it had the very heavy, very slow electric sliding
Yes.
doors down the side. And looking at it as well, there's the first generation, I think, of the Lexus RH, which this was before it went hybrid. So at least it's relatively reasonable to try and maintain at home. But we're sort of teetering on the edge of sort of cars becoming incredibly technical to maintain at home. A lot of the cars on the list, Austin Maestro, Ford Maverick, Citroën Saxo, Peugeot 106, you can fettle with those on your driveway and keep them going with a basic toolkit. But we're sort of on the edge here of sort of specialist tools and needing very complicated electronics to keep cars going. It's sort of very much not necessarily the edge of extinction, but the edge of needing to find a new way to preserve classic skills and the parts for it. I think
Yeah,
you're definitely right.
and there is some interesting work going on in the world of sort of supporting parts, sort of particularly building on the work around 3D printing, and also using AI to sort of solve some of the nuttier problems that they get around things like how do you resuscitate a dead ECU. These are kind of the things that are being tackled now. So it's more around 10 years ago, it would have been things like, how do you do coat work? But now it's more, those kind of things, electronics, that those are the kind of things that are keeping specialists up at night. But there is a lot of work going on already, because they know that the market is currently, the hot cars are sort of 80s, 90s cars, but in the not too distant future, it's going to be, late 2000s, even sort of, 2010 cars that are the ones that are going to be increasingly sought after by enthusiasts.
I mean, you mentioned sort of recreating ECUs. This gives a little insight into the somewhat lavish world that I often inhabit, which was I was enjoying some gin and tonics at the Royal Automobile Club and chatting with some members there who were sort of discussing one of their sort of colleagues has a business which is reproducing ECUs and control units for sort of more modern classic cars. And he said, and it seems to be a booming market, that trend is happening and that sort of industry
Absolutely.
is starting up. I think it's got obviously got to wait until it's sort of scaled up and sort of starts to approach the more sort of approachable classics. They were talking about sort of Aston Martins and Porsches from the early noughties and sort of your L322 Range Rovers, but eventually that will trickle down and it will start to preserve these cars. But again, extinction isn't an overall threat. You've got to remember that there is, at the moment, I believe I'm correct in saying there is more Triumph Stags on the road than there was at some point in the noughties. So many have been found and revived and brought back that, dwindling numbers don't necessarily mean extinction. There is, through the good grace and care of the classic car world, a chance for these cars to sort of find homes once more.
Absolutely. And I think we will see cars, that we see this with most cars. Very few cars, when you look at the numbers of survivors, they don't just dip and dip and dip to the point where it reaches zero and that's it, they're gone, they're extinct. They normally reach a baseline where there might be a couple of hundred or maybe even a few dozen survivors, but they will usually kind of hover around that baseline, or as you point out, they will start to go up again as enthusiasts start restoring them.
It's a strange crossover between my previous world of zoology and my modern world of classic car motoring, the idea of captive breeding programs for the Rover 200 series. But we'll see how it goes and what good fortune can carry them on into the future. But as you said, a couple of car clubs do rebuff the idea in the piece, and it is good to see those clubs already sort of stepping up and making way to help support their classics, and that'll be something that spreads throughout the hobby. We'll touch quickly then on our lead story, which comes in two pieces. We get sort of under the skin of the Triumph TR7 in this one as it turns 50. We have a quick look at the sort of predecessor in a way to the TR7, its prototype, the Lynx, and then obviously put a TR7 through our classic five trials. And I've always had a bit of a soft spot for the TR7.
Me too. It's I think actually it's not that probably as maligned as it once was. I mean, I remember there was a time when it was quite fashionable to knock the TR7. There was always that story about Cesare looking at it and going around to the other side and saying, "Oh no, they've done the same to the other side as well." It's a bit old hat that now. It's nowadays, I think the TR7 is recognised rightly as, you know, it was the best selling of all the TRs. So that's something really important to remember. It's good fun to drive. As well, I know that there are people who say, "Well, it's a bit saloon like," but actually, if anything, it's quite a sporty saloon. So it's a good fun car to drive. They cost buttons to buy, you know, because there's so many good survivors. And I know the looks are the most divisive aspect about the car, but I think it looks great. You know, those pop-up headlights. That you have to remember that when the car was launched in what this time 50 years ago, it was the future was wedge shaped, and I think it looks fabulous now.
I'd say the convertible versions do look absolutely fantastic, but even sort of the fixed head has grown on me. I love that sort of buttress styled sort of rear to the sort of cabin, and it's quite a handsome car in an odd sort of way. Again, possibly this is skewed because I enjoy my rubber bumpered MG, so something with a giant black smear across the front of it isn't quite such a sort of a visually dissatisfying thing to my eye anymore. But I was gonna say, it's a car that's definitely come around not only within the hobby but within the wider car world, I think, also as
I
modern
think so.
cars
We
have gone heavier.
have seen that with quite a few different cars, and you'll see this in the prices that they make at auctions as well. So it's not just, you know, us, you know, sort of throwing opinions out there. You do see this in the results of cars. But cars like the Austin Allegro, I mean, for years it was fashionable to say that was the worst car Britain ever made. But actually, you know, there's a real passion for those now. And you talked before about what they call the rubber bumper MGBs. Again, that, you know, and for years there was a, you know, sort of a cottage industry in taking the rubber bumpers off them, putting chrome ones on. But if I had one now, I'd keep the original bumpers on, because again, it's still a good looking car, and it's of its time. It's actually a really nice 70s survivor.
There is certainly discussion within the club every time, sort of, once someone rocks up with a rubber bumper, some people will go, "Oh, you're ditching the bumpers," and someone goes, "Oh, you've got to keep them." And
Yeah, I'd
unfortunate
keep
that
them.
the ones on my midget are in very good condition, so I am sort of that's relatively set on keeping them because I like the originality of the car. So again, it's sort of that design, sort of it comes in cycles and it sort of comes back round to its peak, and everyone goes, "Actually, that is quite a smart looking car." And again, to drive, I haven't actually had the chance to enjoy a TR7 on the road yet, but it's a
It's a shame we haven't
lightweight
got
car. It's
Chris
a
with us, because he had one for years, didn't he?
yes,
He did John Player Special liveried TR7 for years, and I know he was a big fan of the TR7 as well. So again, the Classic Car Week, there are plenty of people who are definitely TR7 converts, 100%.
It is a sweet car that's come back round to its time, but
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is really interesting with this, again, when I was looking through the pieces that we put into this week's issue, is the idea that the TR7 was never intended to be a standalone TR sports car. It was meant to be part of a wider family of cars. So obviously, we talk about the Lynx, which was obviously the later 2+2 model. We talk about the fact that it was meant to be a version that replaced the Stag at one point. There was going to be a sort of a 2-litre roadster model, which would have been MG badge, which would have been the replacement for the MGB at one point. There were so many what ifs with this car. So I think actually, when you think about it, BL had, yeah, I think they were genuinely considering that. So we talked before about the future being web shaped, and that would have been something you would have seen not just across Triumph, but probably across MG as well. And it would have, if things had been a bit different in the mid to late 70s, we might have seen all sorts of classics with that sort of look.
It would have been interesting to see sort of the TR7 be the base plate for so many other cars coming through that range. And again, it as we find with a lot of classics, they're an incredible sort of slice of social history of sort of the design, the engineering, the thought process of what people wanted in a car in a certain period of time. And yeah, it's more than just sort of a metal box on four wheels at that point, which is, I think, one of the reasons we really quite enjoy our classics is there is more to them than just a car. And there's plenty of other bits and pieces to enjoy in the latest issue as well. from the behind the scenes on the Top Gear cars, which could be getting scrapped from the National Motor Museum. My Jimny makes another rare appearance in the Our Classics pages as it goes on all manner of adventures over the summer. And we've also got a buying guide for the Lotus Carlton, so plenty shoehorned in. And that's roughly all we've got time for in this week's edition of the podcast. And like I said, there's plenty more top-tier content to enjoy in the printed version as well, events pages, classifieds, and the crossword to boot. So be sure to grab a copy. Thank you, David, for coming on today.
It's been a pleasure as always.
And any chance we could head out to visit our listeners in Melbourne, Australia, and soak up their thriving classic car scene, some Aussie muscle down under.
Oh, if you jet out and put it on expenses, I'm sure it'll be fine.
I'll get it sorted. Anyhow, I've got to get the last of my Interclassics report polished up and put together. So we'll be back next week with a guide to motoring abroad, a word from the team at Vintage Sony, and a triple edition of The Way We Were. Thank you very much for listening.